Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hello, everyone. Hi.
So,
well, winter's not over yet. Got a little snow.
Oh, I know. That was a surprise to wake up to snow this morning here in Iowa, and we'll find out where our guest today is and whether what the weather's like there.
Right.
Who do we have today, Mom?
Well, today we have the author of Knocked Down, and it's Aileen Weintraub. And this book is very interesting. I know everybody's going to want to read it. She is an award-winning author, journalist, and editor. She has written for The Washington Post, Glamour, NBC, and AARP, among others. She has also published several children's books, including Never Too Young, 50 Unstoppable Kids Who Made a Difference, and We Got Game, 35 Female Athletes Who Changed the World. And that's one I want to read. I really do.
And Knocked Down is a high-risk memoir. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Aileen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here and speak with you both today.
And it's kind of nice that, you know, I've got Mom on this interview with us, because there's a lot of your mom in your book, too. And I especially love the quote that you have from her as sort of a blurb on the book. You mind if I read that?
Absolutely.
She wrote, "I was really nervous about this book, but every family has its secrets. So what? Doesn't every mother pack a suitcase full of brisket to bring to her children? This book is about life and relationships and what happens when things don't go as planned. I guess all those years I dropped Aileen off at the library so I could get an hour to myself once in a while really paid off. This is a good story. You should read it. But I'm still leaving the country for a few weeks when it comes out."
Oh, that's precious. That really is.
So, Aileen, tell us sort of what this memoir focuses on.
So, Knocked Down is my story about being a Brooklyn girl who moves to the country, ends up having this whirlwind romance, and ends up on bed rest in a rickety old farmhouse for 5 months because of unusually large fibroids. And as the farmhouse begins to collapse around me because it's old and it's in need of repair, my marriage also starts to fall apart. And all of this is going on while I'm on bed rest, and it's where I finally begin to come to terms with my father's death and the grief I've been holding for him and not processing. And this is happening while I'm trying to fight for the survival of my unborn child.
And
yeah,
and it's so, like, really real. It's very real. And when was this? How long ago was this that you were on bed rest?
Yeah, so I'm pleased to say that my son is 15 years old. This has happened over 15 years ago, but the book itself took 10 years to process and write and rewrite and just really understand what I wanted this book to be about. So I took my time putting it out there in the world.
I'm glad that you did, because it's a gem. It really is.
Oh, thank you. So glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Like when Caroline we were talking about it the other day, and she's like, "This woman just can't get a break." It was. But your sense of humor was, I mean, at least in the book, it never seemed to die. But in reality, were you really able to keep a sense of humor about what was going on during the time? Or was it only with perspective looking back that you could find the funny parts?
You know, I think it was during that time, too. You know, I always say my family is a tough love family. We say it like it is. We try to find the humor in difficult moments, because sometimes the humor is the only thing that gets you through. these chunks of trouble.
True.
And so this book actually started out at the very beginning while I was on bed rest. You know, I was flat on my back. I couldn't write. It was really hard to give that up. And so I would write these 2 or 3 line journals, just journal entries. And then I'd send them out to my friends and family via email just as a way to stay connected. And the journals were kind of funny sometimes. And, you know, because I kind of wanted to entertain my friends and let them know that I was okay, but I was still kind of struggling. And it was just a really good way to keep everyone in the loop, stay connected, and get a little perspective.
I had wondered about that, whether you were, how you remembered so many details about.
Yeah,
about
I was too. Yeah. I was too.
So the journal definitely made the difference for you there. Did you at the time think, okay, there's a book in here?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, all I was thinking is there's a baby in here and I can keep this baby in here. I was not thinking about writing or projects. There's a scene in my book where I come to terms with the fact that I am going to have to give up my job and as a freelance editor. And it's a hard moment for me because I'd always depended on myself financially ever since I'd moved out and, you know, graduated college. And so to give up that autonomy was so hard because, and then our finances started to suffer. So I was not really thinking about my next project. My next project was this child. And it was only 5 years later when I decided to get a book club together and we read Gretchen Rubin's The Happiness Project. And I had kind of put my writing aside for all those years to be a mother. I struggled with postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety. And after the book club, I called my friend and I said, hey, I think I need a happiness project. And I think that project is writing this book and writing about this trauma that I haven't addressed and that I've held on to for so long and giving it light and space into the world. And my friend, you know, she said, go for it. If she said, nah, don't do it, maybe I wouldn't have done it. But she, but she was really encouraging. So, and she was another writer and she was super supportive. And that's, you know, that's how this project really started 5 years later.
And like you mentioned, it also, the book also, you're dealing with the grief around your father's death. Did you know from the beginning that that was going to be an important element of it? Or did that come in through the writing process?
You know, it's so interesting. That really came through the writing process. As I was writing, there were just like little hints and threads. And as I started developing the story, I realized there was a whole other storyline that needed to be brought to life and given space. And so that actually came later where I developed it. So it was already there, but I fleshed it out in later drafts.
So, Caroline, do you have some questions?
Well, you answered the main one I had was about how in the world you remembered all those details. Because that, I mean, that's amazing. It's just amazing.
Yeah. So I, like I said, I had kept some journals. And, you know, when you're on bed rest for 5 months and you're there's not much going on, right? There's a lot going on, but you have a lot of time to think and process and write things down. And so when I started writing that first draft, it wasn't 15 years ago. It was, you know, had been 5 years before. And so I was able to remember a lot of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, you mentioned that your finances were suffering. I'm thinking, and part of it's because your husband bought a business. And it's like, what was he thinking?
The best laid plans, you know?
Yeah. And what a struggle that was. And it was interesting to me that you were pretty aware of what was going on there too. And you learned, and it was a tractor business. So this is a Brooklyn girl now knows everything about tractors.
It is so funny because till this day, I have not mowed one single lawn. And there's a scene in my book where my husband, Chris, is trying to get me to ride a tractor and mow our lawn. And our lawn, by the way, is 6 acres because we had way more acres than that. But our field was very, very big because it was an old farm. And he's trying to get me on this old tractor. And the minute it starts moving, I start flipping out. And it's just hysterical. And I'm screaming at him to shut it off. And he's chasing me because the tractor's just going. And, you know, it should have been videoed. But that was my foray into lawn care.
Okay. My daughter's boyfriend is a city boy. He grew up in L.A. And my daughter's dad is a country guy. And so they were visiting out on the farm, and the dad got the boyfriend on a tractor, and the exact same thing happened. It was exactly the same, and he's never getting on a tractor again.
Yeah, I think they like to have 2 feet on the ground at all times.
Yep.
Even cars make this a little uneasy, I'd say.
Oh, he doesn't like to drive either. Yeah, yeah.
Me neither. I learned to drive when I was 29, and I moved up to the Hudson Valley. That's how I learned to drive. Somebody else had to drive my car up for me. And then I slowly started to drive, and I still think it's a death machine every time.
I got to get you and Rob together because this is almost exactly his story, except it was West Coast instead of East.
Okay, 3 a.m. I can get anywhere in New York City. No problem. Put me in a car at 7 p.m. and I panic. Yeah.
It's interesting because, like, Caroline, it's the exact opposite, too. You would be terrified in a city trying to get it.
Yeah.
To get around right. The city. She can't do it. But out here in the middle of nowhere, you're just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I got a map, you know, if I need it.
So do you still have the tractor business?
We do still have it.
Really?
It has grown quite a bit. And it's doing really well. Yeah. Okay. And actually just put up a little free library there because I want to finally like merge our two passions. So I'm going to have this little free library right outside this big power equipment. You know, all the books that I love in there. So,
how wonderful. How wonderful. So at the time when you were on this bed rest, you had been working as a freelance editor. Were you also a freelance writer at that point? You were working on a book at that point too.
Yeah.
And I'm really disappointed that you never finished that book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I had started out in New York City as an editor in a publishing company. And I was originally a copy editor, and I became a developmental editor. And then I went freelance. And during that time, I also wrote quite a few children's books. So I was really doing both. And at that time that I was on bed rest, I was really focusing on editing more than writing, but I always went back and forth.
But is Knockdown your first adult book?
It is my first adult book. And as for the other book, that it's called The 10-Second Seduction, and everybody asks me about that book. And it is safely packed away in one of my closets, in the back of a closet, and that's probably where it should stay.
Tell us what the theme of that book was going to be.
So the premise of that book is that when you meet a man, you know within 10 seconds if you're going to have a connection. And so each chapter was a different man that I had met or dated. And so I wrote most of that book, and I had started sending it on submission. But then I met my husband, and I was like, you know, maybe he doesn't want all my exploits out there. So for him, he's a pretty quiet, reserved person. So I figured, you know, I'll put that away for a while.
You know, you could fictionalize it. You could make it like a Bridget Jones Diary kind of thing. or something.
Definitely a possibility. And it's funny because I have never written fiction. All my children's books are nonfiction. I'm a journalist. You know, I do reported pieces, my essays. And so fiction would be new territory to explore. It might be fun.
It would be. And it's interesting. The woman that I talked to last week, Annette Libeskind-Berkovitz, had written a multiple nonfiction books, some memoirs, some other, a biography of her father from the Holocaust, and a lot of nonfiction. And now she's written a fiction book. And she was talking about how much she enjoyed. Now, it was historical fiction, so there was a lot of fact in it, too. But how much she enjoyed weaving, using her creativity along with the facts of the story. You might enjoy that, too.
Absolutely. And, you know, I happen to love historical fiction, too. Fiction is definitely something to explore. My next project is still up in the air. We'll see what happens with it. But
wow. Now, have you been... you know, you said you took the 5 years off focusing on being a mom, and then you started writing. Of course, that didn't mean you weren't still focused on being a mom. So while you're writing this book, did you start taking on other writing projects too at that point?
Yes. And, you know, I didn't really take 5 years off completely. I was still doing some freelance. And as a matter of fact, when my son was 2 weeks old, I had an editor call me up and say, do you want to write a book about the rock band Kiss?
No.
That sounds kind of random.
Yeah. So I did. I wrote a children's book. It was for high school kids about the rock band Kiss, and while I have this two-week-old baby, and I'm bleary-eyed, I'm getting no sleep, and I said, I can do it, but it's going to take a while. And so that was the first prop. So I didn't really take off a lot of time.
Apparently not.
it was really hard. My husband was still working 12-hour days. He would come home at 7 o'clock. I would hand him the baby, and from 7 to 9, I would write. I would try to write when my son was sleeping, but that was very rare. He very rarely slept. So,
okay, we have to say this. Before I had kids, which I had them very young, but I had this image of you take your kids to the park and they play on the swing and you sit there and read or write. That does not happen that way, does it?
Yes, this is actually a very important topic, and it's one that's really near and dear to my heart, is how do we support mothers who feel that they have to do it all? And how do we give them permission to say, hey, it's okay to take a step back and ask for help, ask for support? And what can we do as a society to make this conversation, or keep this conversation going, or even start this conversation to make sure that mothers feel seen and heard and can feel fulfilled and not just become mom, but can be a whole person.
And do you have some ideas in that regard?
Yeah, I do have some ideas. I think it's an ongoing conversation, but I think the biggest thing is to be able to be kind to ourselves, to ask for help when we need it. So many moms feel like we are supposed to be super mom and do everything and juggle everything. And it's okay to find support where we can. I think we have to advocate for our needs with our family members, with our spouses, and say, hey, and claim our time and allow ourselves some joy in that. And so many of us lose ourselves. I completely lost my identity in those early years. And it was so hard to hang on to being a writer. And I owe it to my mother, because my mother had always said, you know, this is what, it's important to stay the course and focus on yourself too.
You
good
know,
advice.
It is good advice. And I wonder, for me, I didn't lose myself as a mother of young children. I had two, because I hadn't found myself yet. I was so young. And so I wonder in a way if that's almost easier, because then I had plenty of time later to find myself. So one of the advantages of being a teen mom, you can't lose what you didn't have.
Right. How many children do you have?
I have two, and the first one I was 18 when my son was born, and then 22 when my daughter was born, and they're now in their 40s. So it's,
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. And the funny thing, recently my granddaughter was asking, how do people know they want to have kids? And I said, well, your dad always knew. He always loved kids. He always knew he wanted to have kids. And which I thought was, you know, a great answer for a little girl to hear. And then she goes, well, what about you? How did you know? And because I hadn't thought this through, and because I have a tendency towards honesty, I said, I didn't. It was an accident. Which was probably not what you should tell a little girl about her father's birth. But anyway, it worked out fine. So before we go on, I would like to remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Aileen Weintraub, author of Knocked Down, a High-Risk Memoir. So when you're writing a memoir, of course, you're writing about family. And as your mother said, she was worried about it. There's secrets. But how do you navigate the possibility of hurting people's feelings by putting out to everyone in the world what was happening in a private moment?
This is so difficult. And I really had to think about what my story was going to do to other people and how they were going to feel about it. And, you know, I gave it a lot of thought. And what I decided is, when I wrote a scene, I said, is this necessary for the arc of the story? Does this give the story forward momentum? Can I leave it out? And if I could leave out a painful scene, then I left it out, because my intention is not to hurt anyone. It's to tell a story. And there are painful moments in there. And there are some moments in there that my mother and I discussed that she wasn't so happy that I had included. And I did leave out a lot of things that just were not completely necessary, because I was able to get the point across without it. And I think I accomplished that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was your mother, also your brother to some extent, and your husband, of course, were kind of the three people who could have been offended in some sense by what you wrote. So did you get each of their clearance on the parts? Like, I mean, did you give them a chance to say, please don't include this?
So this is always a conversation that comes up with memoirists.
Yeah.
Permission. And so do we give people permission to alter our stories? That's a hard question.
It is.
And so say, in all honesty, the answer is no. This was my story, and I allowed my mother to read it. And she, you know, I didn't have anyone read it until I had a signed book contract, because I was like, well, if I don't sell this book, then there's no reason to have anyone read it.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And so much might come out of it anyway, and, you know, be edited out or deleted. And so my mother read it and she loved it. And we had some conversations, and, you know, during the process, we had some conversations, because there are certain things, especially around my father and his death, that I wanted to make sure I got right. And then my husband read it, and I was really nervous about that too. And yeah. He gets up a lot earlier than I do. I write late into the night. He's an early bird. He's out. And I would come down in the morning while he was reading. I had printed it out in, you know, and he was reading, and he's such a stoic guy. He's super, like, holds his emotions close. And I would see him sitting at the kitchen counter reading, laughing hysterically with tears coming down his face. And to me, that was everything. And he was like very happy with the book. He thought it was really well written. And throughout the process, he had explained to me, you know, he said, write your story. Don't worry about me.
Oh, what a guy.
Yeah. He was like, don't worry about, you know, just put it out there. My brother, on the other hand, you know, he had some feelings and we had to talk them through. And he didn't read the book before it was published. I sent him some excerpts because he's not in every scene.
No.
So he read parts of it and his whole family has read it. And my brother and I are incredibly close. Which wasn't always the case if you read the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been interesting. And our relationship really developed after my son was born and while I was on bed rest. And so I don't know if he's read the whole book yet.
Well, he doesn't come off looking bad.
Right.
You know, it's just normal sibling stuff from when you were kids, you know. It's like...
I think for him, it's more about the memories of our childhood and how each of us remember certain events because nobody remembers the same event in the same way. And he doesn't necessarily want to see how somebody else remembers it because they're so precious to him, those memories.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true that you don't remember it the same way at all. I have had this conversation with my sister where she remembers some interactions between my father and I, or my father and me, and that she was traumatized by, and I don't even remember them.
Right. It's really true how sometimes watching an event can be even more traumatizing than experiencing it.
True.
And how we process it differently.
And she was younger, so she was processing it. She told me once she was always terrified for me because I would do things to get in trouble that I could get in trouble for, and she was terrified on my behalf, and I was kind of oblivious, I guess. Yeah. Well, Aileen, would you like to read from the Knockdown for us?
Yes, sure.
Great.
Absolutely. So I'm going to set this scene up first. It's week 28. I am on bed rest at this point for 10 weeks. And it really ties into what we've been talking about motherhood and my mother especially. And this is a scene where I'm deep into bed rest. I am feeling a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. I feel like I've failed as a mother before I've even become a mother. And my mother comes in and teaches me what it really means to be a mother. Mm. So this is one of my favorite scenes. The doorbell was stuck as usual, and I knew it would take me a solid 2 minutes to get out of bed to answer it. Satchi Red was running in circles and rolling her head along the ground like she was possessed. When I finally opened the door, though the bell was still ringing, there was only a brown box sitting on the welcome mat. I unstuck the bell, picked up the box, and glanced over at Satchi Red, who predictably had a thin string of drool on either side of her chops. And I imagined that if she could speak, she would say, "This bell is trying to kill us." I stuck my head around the door and saw the Charlie Chaplin UPS guy sitting in his truck. He waved at me with a smile before pulling away. The mystery box had no return address. After struggling back into bed, I opened it, hoping to find something glamorous. The inner package was wound tight in 5 layers of bubble wrap and sealed with silver duct tape. It was either incredibly fragile or explosive. Several minutes into deconstructing the wrapping, alternating between anticipation and frustration, my suspicions grew. And by the time I tore the last piece of tape off the box to reveal a Tupperware covered in industrial strength tinfoil, the jig was up. I opened the container and found a partially thawed casserole. My mother had a yellow Post-it with the words Noodlekugel written on it. And beneath that was a stick figure family, one of which had a giant belly and another that was, I think, supposed to be a dog, but more like a dead rabbit. I put the kugel aside for Chris. Though not the intent, this half-thawed kugel made me feel like a failure. I had failed at keeping my household running, but even more, I had failed at the very essence of womanhood. How was it that I could be so determined and brave, quitting my New York City job, joining AmeriCorps, moving to the country without knowing a single soul, but the one thing that I had been born and bred for, making babies, literally knocked me down. Then I remembered my vow to be kind to myself. I called my mother to thank her for the package. The first words I blurted out were, "I think it's time for you to come for a visit." My mother turned out to be the one person who showed up, knew what to do, and had the best advice. Maybe even better advice than my father might have had. The last few weeks, I had noticed a minute shift in my relationship with her. Sure, we were still pushing each other's buttons, but we were talking more too. How had she become so smart after all these years? Had she spent my long, insufferable youth waiting for me to come around, filled with frustration, feeling that nobody appreciated her? Regardless, she continued to do what she had always considered her job, caring for her family, no matter how defiant or selfish we were. This kugel was not just noodles and oil, and it didn't matter that I couldn't eat it. The main ingredient, the only one that truly mattered, was pure, organic love. The next day, she was at my door. I lowered the volume on the television when I heard the familiar thump, thump, thump of my mother schlepping her Schlock store suitcase up the steps. She came in the house melting from the heat, and with one awkward swing, threw her suitcase up on the pink and blue striped chair. Hands on hips, trying to catch her breath, she turned to Chris, who had picked her up at the bus stop, and said, "Open it." She pointed at the suitcase. He thought it was a joke. I could see from the look on his face that he was in no way prepared to unpack his mother-in-law's delicates. It was only when she insisted between hyperventilating breaths that he coaxed the zipper around its track and then quickly took a step back as if expecting a cobra to jump out. There was not a single item of clothing in this bag. Instead, it was filled with meat. My mother fluttered her lips and collapsed in a chair as though she had just completed the New York City Marathon. "Ma, I'm a vegetarian." "Well, I don't know what to make you. You don't eat anything." "That must be an entire cow." "You do this to torture me." My mother wasn't trying to be overdramatic. One of the biggest ways she showed her love was through food. It really was torture for her that my diet was so limiting. And the one thing she could do in times of hardship, cook, wasn't going to help. But by late afternoon, she had moved on from meat to other pressing domestic matters. "You want I should use bleach on your colors?" she asked as she hefted a huge basket of laundry on her hips. "We don't have bleach." "I brought my own." "You brought your own bleach from Brooklyn? They let you on the bus with bleach? How do they know? They don't strip search me at Port Authority. It's color safe." I had no words, but it did make me think, what exactly is color safe bleach? Is it even bleach at all? How do they get the whitening agent out? A dirty pile of laundry had spurred the deepest philosophical musings I'd had in months. After this, I'll do the floors. I brought something for that too, she called out as she left the room.
And that's Aileen Weintraub reading from Knockdown, a High-Risk Memoir. One thing I found really interesting is that, you know, you found that, I mean, the reason that you were on bed rest was because of what you called the monsters.
Yeah.
And do you want to, you know, obviously you're open about sharing that information because it's in the book, that you had fibroid, very large fibroid tumors.
Yes.
And that you didn't know and until much later that this was ran in the family.
Yes, so. Yes. And so this is something that I realize is that we don't speak enough about our reproductive health as women. We don't talk about it to other women, especially generations before us. My mother kept her hysterectomy a secret. It wasn't really a secret, but it was just wasn't discussed. She talks about it late in the book, how it's just, she's like, it's just something I had to do. And I was like, well, what do you mean? It's just something you had to do. Did you ever process this? It's like she had a hysterectomy, took a couple days off and just went on with her life. And if we don't release that trauma, it becomes part of us.
And you were a child at the time, right? So you were.
I was a child and I didn't realize what was going on and I was very scared. And later I talked about that with my brother. And I was like, did you know this at the time? And he's like, no, I had no idea. I just knew mom had some sort of surgery and was really sick. And, you know, that's not to put any kind of blame on my mother at all. She was protecting us. She was holding it together. She knew that she was the caretaker in the family. And this was just something she had to get done and keep going.
But it seems like it would have been that when you had these fibroids, that would have been the time to bring this up. and Caroline, I hope you don't mind me telling this, but I, as a child, my mother was, I was the oldest girl of five kids, and mom was in the hospital like once a year from the time I was in like third grade to about seventh or eighth grade. And so there was always, and I had a lot of responsibility from that. But up until quite recently, I thought she'd had back surgery. And mom, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And you finally told me you never had back surgery.
No, I never had back surgery. I had fibroids too.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why I finally had to have a hysterectomy because it would not stop bleeding. And that was after I had, of course, several miscarriages. And I don't know if they caused the miscarriages or not. They, you know, they never did an ultrasound. So I don't know. You know, things have changed so much since I was, you know, childbearing age in medicine that they can do so much more now than they could then. It's really amazing.
But it did surprise me because I had thought, the time when I thought she had back surgery, I thought she had a slip disc. That's what I thought for years and years. And then later, mom, you told me that you'd had, I think, another miscarriage or something at that point. But I knew about the other miscarriages. So it surprised me that you didn't tell us about that one. But do you remember anything about why?
Well, there was an ecoptic pregnancy in that.
Yeah, and I knew about that.
Thing.
I knew about that one. So anyway, you're right, Aileen, and this is a similar generation probably as your mother, that it was not talked about.
No.
Absolutely. And we have so much further to go with this. And there needs to be more money poured into research on women's reproductive health. We need to be able to have open conversations with our healthcare professionals to be seen and heard, to make sure that we're not misdiagnosed. And, you know, there's a scene, I don't want to give too much away about my book, but there's a scene later on where one of the specialists I'm seeing says, well, I'm not sure you needed to be on bed rest.
I know. I could not believe that when I read that. Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah, if you delve into the research, bed rest for so long was just something that they did because they didn't know what else to do. And now that is really slowly changing. But the fact that someone can pluck you out of life and it can affect your finances, it can affect your marriage, your autonomy, your mental health, and not to really sit down and consider the risk-benefit analysis is really alarming and something that we need to talk about. And I wish I had said to my doctors at the time, okay, are there any other options? And they might have said no. And so that's where we are, and that's where we need to make big improvements.
But even when that one specialist said that, your regular physician said, no, you still should be on bed rest.
Yes.
And so how did you know what to do?
So at that point, I had already lost everything. It was late in the game. I only had a few weeks left, or like maybe I can't remember exactly when, but it was less than 2 months at that point. And I just said, you know, I'm going to stay the course. I'm not going to pick up my life and walk out of the house like nothing happened. I was so traumatized, and I was still in excruciating pain all the time because the fibroids hurt so much because they were pressing on my cervix. And now you're like, you know, 7 or 8 months pregnant. It's not like you're just going to up and start over after being in bed for so long. I've lost all my muscle mass. And I was like, you know, I'm going to stay here. This is what this physician is telling me to do. It's working so far. My baby is still inside my body, which is what we want. So I'm going to stay the course at this point. So I was too far along to change direction, I think, at that point.
Yeah. Plus, like you said, it's not like at that point, even if you hadn't been on bed rest, your mobility would have been limited anyway, you know, when you're that far along.
Yeah. And, you know, even after my child was born, I remember having to go to the grocery store and get my baby out of the car and strap him to me in like a baby Bjorn or whatever. And I was walking around the aisles of the grocery store so slowly, it felt like I was barely moving because I lost so much muscle mass. I forgot how to walk. My hips were in so much pain. Those muscles hadn't been used in so long.
And you were athletic before.
I was athletic. It took a very long time to get back to it. Today, I just went on a 3.5 mile run before our interview.
Oh, congratulations.
And I'm a boxer. I box. But it took years. And it was really hard to get my body back.
You know, we talked about, you know, different members of your family and their reactions to the book. What about your son? He's old enough, theoretically, to read it. Has he read it? Do you want him to read it?
So a lot of people ask me this question, and it's a really difficult one to answer. And I don't know if he read it. He is a typical teenager. I have told him he knows exactly what it's about. I've left it out for him. And so I have a feeling he's flipped through it. But I think this is a story that he's going to come back to much later when he's older, and he's going to sit down when he has his own family, and he'll read it and appreciate it then.
Yeah. Did he, as a child, did he know about you having to have been on bed rest and, you know, how difficult the pregnancy was?
I think so. I think he's always known, and how much I cherish him. It's part of that story of how so important he is to me, how I fought for his life and my life, and how I think it made me, it actually, being on bed rest led to postpartum anxiety because I was so worried about keeping my child alive before he was born that when he was finally born, I was like, oh my God, now I really have to keep him alive. It's much harder because he's outside my body.
Yeah. And there's so many things that can go wrong. Yeah. Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Aileen Weintraub, author of Knocked Down, a High-Risk Memoir. Now, this is published by University of Nebraska Press, and it's part of a series, what's it called, American Lives?
Yep, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and how your book found a home there?
So American Lives is a series of different stories about lives across, just memoirs and lives across the country, and they do essays and all sorts of other things. The University of Nebraska Press has many imprints, and they are amazing. They're supportive. I love my team. And how did it find a home there? I think that, you know, my agent put it out on submission, and we actually got two offers, and this one felt like home. This felt like the right fit. It was a hard decision, but I think I made the right one, and I couldn't be happier with them.
Well, how did you find an agent? Because that can be a really difficult challenge for a lot of authors.
Yeah, so finding an agent can be just as hard as like, there's no easy path to publishing. And I think it's about endurance and perseverance. And I found an agent by submitting a proposal and submitting my manuscript and querying, just like most people find agents. It wasn't, you know, through connections or anything like that. And it did help that I had published a lot of children's books. And so my agent has sold my last children's book, We Got Game, and she sold this memoir, so it's been fantastic.
Did you have an agent previously for your children's books, or were you working directly with the publishers there?
Right. So because I had come from a children's publishing background, I already knew so many editors, and I worked directly with them, and I actually got the agent for Knockdown first. And then I was like, hey, wait a second, you know, I'm a children's book author, and I probably should have had an agent for my children's books much sooner than I did, but I was negotiating all those contracts. And then I realized how important it really is, because suddenly my contracts were a lot better.
Well, that's good to know, because I'm sure sometimes, you know, we live in such a DIY, do-it-yourself world,
yeah,
that there's probably a lot of writers out there who think, well, why do I need an agent? I can just do that all myself. But so you've done it both ways, and you'd recommend an agent.
Well, you know, there's many paths to publishing, and I think what works for each individual is different. So what works for me is having an amazing agent in my corner who can advocate for me, and then I don't have to worry about those things. For other people, they want complete control over their work, and that's totally acceptable.
I just think that your husband was an amazing person to have all those problems at work. And I mean, that's really something. Did he finally get a hold on that business and able to handle all those people that were always giving him problems?
So he's a very diplomatic person. His customers love him. He's really got a good rapport with our community, our local community. And I think after a year, it's like with anything else, when you have something that, you know, you step into a new role, it's really hard and there's a huge learning curve. And as the years go by, you know what works and what doesn't work.
Well, what made it really hard was he unknowingly bought a business that had a bad reputation.
Right.
with customers, had a lot of issues with customers, and he was thrust into having to deal with them right at the beginning of his learning curve. So not even having to deal with his own mistakes, he had to deal with the prior owner's mistakes.
Yeah, there was a lot of cleaning up and a lot of, you know, owning a tractor shop is like owning a car dealership or mechanic. Nobody wants to take their car in to get it fixed. And nobody wants to pay money for new brakes. And nobody really, unless you have a really good mechanic, you're never sure what is, if you're being taken or, and so my husband really had to prove that he was not like the last guy. He was very honest. He's very fair. And I think that he's really managed to do that.
Well, that says a lot for him. And you're right. It's very hard to know. I've had that experience. Is this person, you know, are they telling me I need a $1,500 repair when really I only need a $200 repair because they know that I don't know any better? Mm-hmm. You don't know.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's more, especially in a small town like ours, it's more about building community and building relationships. And so are you going to swindle this customer or are you going to make this customer trust you so they come back for years and years?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Aileen, let's talk a little bit more about your writing process. So for this book, you started with these journal notes that you had. How did you go from that to developing the story arc? Because that is, the way you structured the book was sort of, you had this before pregnancy section, and then you had week by week or even half week by half week during the bed rest. You know, I'm curious about how that structure took form and how you formed how you decided on what the best way to tell this story was.
Sure. So this actually goes back to those journal entries, because the very first draft of the book, each chapter was a journal entry. And so we actually had the journal entries at the top as an intro. And then in later drafts, I realized this is just a summary of the chapter. I don't need the chapter summary at the top. And so we took out the journal entries. And so that's how we structured it. And so it really was week by week based on these entries.
But then when you're weaving in the past, your childhood, your relationship with your father, your mother, your brother, it seems so seamless. But I'm guessing that it didn't happen quite so easily.
Yeah, so it's about development, right? And so what I would say, if I could give a writer advice, any one bit of advice, is find in a group of writers that you can meet with twice a month or once a month who can read your work and give you a perspective. That is how this book came to fruition and was so developed, because I had a group of writers. We met at this bakery every 2 weeks. We had the best red velvet cupcakes. And because snacks are a very important part of the writing process. And they really helped me develop scenes. And, you know, this goes back to incorporating the thread of my father in the first drafts. He was there and the grief was there, but it wasn't as well developed. And so I actually wrote that separately at first. And then weaved it in. And there was a time with one of these other writers I work with. We went to her house and she had this huge dining room table and we printed out the manuscript. And all of us, I mean, God bless these women. We all sat there and said, okay, this scene could go here. This can go here. And we mapped it out.
Wow.
And then you had to make sure the transitions were smooth after you inserted them. And so this is why the book took 10 years to write.
I can see that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So as I'm reading the book, I feel like you're just telling me the story. You're just talking to me. It's so, and your voice comes through so clearly. And is that just how you write, or do you do a lot of, I think you made a comment in the acknowledgments about a writing retreat you took where you had to eliminate your darlings.
Oh, yes.
So do you do a lot of that?
There was so when I wrote this book, and I think a lot of people do this, the first draft I wrote for me and only me. I got it all out. And then subsequent drafts I wrote for my audience. And so that's when you have to cut and cut and say, is this part, is this contributing to the arc of the story and the forward momentum? And is it necessary or is it a side story? And what purpose does each scene serve in the book?
Wow. You really put a lot of thought into this.
Thank
you. Thank you also for the compliment that you can hear my voice and it feels like I'm just talking, because yes, that's how I write most of my essays and this book, is I want readers to feel like I am their friend sitting on their back porch having a cup of tea or a glass of wine, and we're talking about important issues that women need to talk about and feel comfortable talking about.
Well, I think you've accomplished that. Yeah. But so, then the risk is, are you going to have people come up to you and start talking to you like they're your, like they know you? And how will you react to that?
Well, so far the feedback has been amazing. And I just went to a huge conference in Philly. It's a writer's conference. It's called AWP. And so many people have come up to me during that conference. Like, they know me. They said they recognize me from my hair, because of course we're all wearing masks. And they were talking about my book, and the buzz has been amazing. And when you get past that initial greeting, you can really connect with someone. And that's so important to me. There was a couple of weeks ago, I was at my local gym, and I met a woman I hadn't seen since before the pandemic. And we're just acquaintances. And she knew about my book, and I was telling her how I wrote it because I wanted to release this trauma and I wanted to connect with other women so they could feel comfortable releasing their trauma. And right there in the gym, she started telling me this harrowing story of an experience that she had. And I was like, this is what it's about. This is right here. I didn't know her very well. I only knew her from seeing her around the community. And she was telling me, and she was confiding in me, and that was such a beautiful moment. And so I felt like I had accomplished something with this book in that moment.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. And thank you
for writing this book.
Thank you. And thank you for reading it and having me on your program.
And we're about out of time. Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. There is probably no family that can truthfully put a sign out that says, there is no trouble here.
And your mom would agree with that, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And if readers would like to reach out, they can reach me on my website at aileenweintraub.com or follow me on Twitter at Aileen Weintraub. I love Twitter. I love to joke around on Twitter.
All right. I'm going to go follow you right now. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.